We're going to be turning this into a podcast and we'll be distributing it. So first of all, I would like to introduce the author of the case that you have been looking at. And the author is Elaine Eisenman. Elaine is a member of the board of directors of the public company Designer Brands. I bought a pair of sneakers there just the other day. It's one of North America's largest designers, producers, and retailers of footwear and accessories with more than 1,000 points of distribution. She has served on the board of the Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates. She's been chair of the parent company compensation committee. The parent company is Atrius Health. Elaine is a member of the core faculty team of Scalerator. How do you pronounce that, Elaine?
Scalerator.
It builds entrepreneurial ecosystems to drive economic growth. And I'll be asking you to tell us a little bit more about that. Elaine also serves on the board as the chair of the Private Directors Association. And I'll be asking Elaine to talk about that. For 9 years, she served on the board of U.S. Trust. Was that U.S. Trust?
U.S. Tobacco.
U.S. Tobacco. Okay.
Greenwich-based spit tobacco, not cigarettes.
Okay. Elaine is the author of Betrayed, A Survivor's Guide to Lying, Cheating, and Double Dealing. Her perspectives on corporate governance, innovation, and resilience have appeared in the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Business Week. Elaine was previously a dean at Babson College. Her PhD in organization behavior is from New York University. So first, Elaine, tell us about Scalerator.
So when I was at Babson, as probably you all know, Babson's known for entrepreneurship, number one in the world for entrepreneurship education for the past, I think we're up to 30 years now, right, Lisa? Lisa's on the board at Babson. And when I was there, I was Dean of Executive and Enterprise Education and a small faculty team, myself and three other people, in response to a request from a significant foundation in Manizales, Colombia, came to us and said, how do we keep all our bright young people in Manizales, because they all leave as soon as they graduate one of the five universities in Manizales. We said, we don't know, but we'll figure it out. And we created what we call Scalerator, which is a 6-month program where we work with private and public partnerships to create an economic unit that supports the growth of high aspiration private companies who will stay in the region and drive growth through expanding, obviously, their markets, but also expanding their employee base. So since that time, which was in 2007, we have worked throughout Latin America, the United States, we're in Atlanta, Canada, the Caribbean, also in Europe, and we have worked with over 60 cohorts and have demonstrated that for the programs that we work with, where we also develop mentors in the community, that we have a minimum of 25% growth above current business plan for each of the companies who've gone through Scalerator in their first year post-Scalerator. So it really drives significant growth, and it's a phenomenal program that I'm very, very proud of. So that's Scalerator.
No, does anybody have any questions about Scalerator before we get to the PDA? Okay, so Babs is also chair of the board of directors of the Private Directors Association. Would you tell us a little bit about PDA and how would you differentiate it from, let's say, the National Association of Corporate Directors?
PDA is the only nonprofit association solely devoted to private company governance. NACD has a small division for private companies, but NACD is really focused on public companies. PDA is focused solely on private company governance. It was started about 8 years ago in Chicago, and since that time, we have grown to about 3,000 members. We have 20 chapters around the country with a focus on governance education for both individuals and for private companies. Networking and support for increased diversity on private company boards. Thank you, Babs, for just buying my book.
Yeah, Babson.
Now we're going to do a QVC thing. I could hold up the cover. It's a very cool cover. Do I hear anyone else? So PDA is a great organization. We have I was introduced to PDA actually by Lisa Thompson, who said to me, "You need to join the Boston chapter." Somehow I became president of the Boston chapter about 11 minutes after I joined. I was the only person who didn't step back. I immediately made it New England, and then became involved in a small group who wanted to really focus on building a much stronger national organization to support the chapters and to help manage growth. And somehow I became chairman of that board. It was a full, all chapters voted election, and then the board voted me chair. And we've just nominated and added a new CEO for PDA, who comes from a long line of association background. She's a phenomenal CEO and was just named a fellow of the association, the American Society of Association Executives. So we're very, very proud of her. And we're growing great guns, so you should check out PDA. Anyone who has an interest in private company governance should definitely check us out. Happy to take emails. Keep your letters coming. So that's PDA. It's awesome. Really, I think what's wonderful about the organization, and this also is very different than ACD, is we're a very flat organization. We draw heavily from chapters and volunteers. We do not have a strong infrastructure or any structure. And so it's a very tight organization for networking and relationship building. And that's really the core of who we are, building those relationships and networks. I think Lisa's on two boards that she found her through PDA connections. And we have lots of stories like that. Our meetings meet in person multiple times over the year. We started as a virtual, New England chapter started virtually. No one had met each other. The chapter started during COVID and no one had ever seen each other in person for 3 years. And yet we grew across the country very, very rapidly because of that close focus on networking and relationship building. And of course—
Yeah, invited me to give a talk a few years ago on why is a board called a board?
Yep, it was a great talk.
A sofa or a chair, why is it called a board? And so it's the story of the first board of directors and how it was structured, what its roles were. And it really underscores how little has changed in corporate governance in 450 years. So if any of you would like a copy of that talk, I can give you the URL for it.
It really is a great talk.
Thank you.
Here's my book. Oh, you can't see it because I Anyway, so this case comes from when we started to do Betrayed. My co-author and I weren't sure if anybody would talk to us. What we found is we couldn't get people to stop talking. And the number of people who called and said, "Here, you're doing a book on Betrayed. Is it only personal betrayal?" And we said, "No, personal and professional." So, but what we discovered was betrayal is betrayal, whether it's personal or professional. The only chapter that is devoted to something different is a chapter entitled Family Business, because betrayal in family business is above and beyond any betrayal in any other setting. But this is one of the cases. So this is not a case I personally experienced, but was a case that the author called and said, "Please include my case because I was so badly betrayed, but I have some important lessons to share."
That's great. So speaking of lessons, why don't we go around the room and look at the different groups of what they decided. The first group is Cynthia, Jim, and Robert. You have a spokesperson?
Yes, me.
Hey, Robert.
Larry and Elaine, do you want me to go through the answer the questions, or how would you like me to give you the summary?
Elaine, what?
Larry, based on your experience, what do you think is best?
I think just give us the summary, and what would you do?
So the first red flag certainly was when Ellie was on her way in and asked about this odd unit and was told by the board, don't worry about it. And she took the job anyways. She's certainly on the hook for this. We're in investigation mode. Cynthia, who has significant background in this particular industry, was coaching both Jim and I in terms of the lack of controls that were in place for these for this problem to become such a problem. We're not at all in agreement with the whole no comment continued answer coming from the company and the board encouraging the no comment. We debated whether if we're Ellie, do we quit or what do we do? I think we settled on let's keep this going to try to figure out what the heck happened here, because right now she has more questions than answers. And I mean, if we fire her, I'm not sure what we would do to replace her if we're the board. But certainly the board has some culpability associated with this. But Ellie is going to bear the brunt of this problem in our view. So any questions, Jim, Cynthia, anything to add to that? What did I miss?
Okay, good. Let's go to the next group.
Okay, can I ask Bob a question?
Yeah.
When you said Ellie will bear the brunt, are you saying she should bear the brunt?
Well, as a CEO, I mean, she as the CEO and from an external perspective, this happened on her watch. So, and I'm not sure whether she's in a, she might be unhappy and want to throw some of the board members under a bus, but I'm not sure that that would play out or do any good, frankly speaking, because she's the front and center face of this company was our view. Cynthia, Jim, do I have that right or did I misunderstand?
Yeah, I think so. And we identified the first red flag is Ellie having some concerns about what became this problem, and then seemingly set them aside and went along with the board. And it's as if when that happened, she limited her ability to act later on. She could have stopped it then, either by leaving or by insisting on investigating it. But that day had passed.
Elaine, did we answer your question?
Yeah, we did. Thank you.
Let's move on to the next group. That would be George, Ingrid, Lisa, and Lou.
Okay, and I'm the spokesperson. So, we also, I'll start with red flags. We focused maybe a little bit more on the arrogance, Wall Street swagger, intimidation, sabotage of other employees, and that there was no, apparently that was let to slide and be part of the company culture. It seemed that the board was too involved in an operating decision to keep this unit when the CEO questioned it, that there should have been more maybe give and take about, why and what's the case for the decision that she caved in. We talked a lot about whether or not the board was too involved in the current problem and agreed that there should, that it doesn't appear that they had a crisis management plan or team, that they should have, that the board and the management should be working together. It doesn't look like they are. The no comment we thought was the wrong answer, that's only going to make things worse the way news works in this world, and that they needed to have some type of statement that the board management was on top of it, that they brought in the FBI, that they were working on containing the financial damage, things like that. There's mention of a risk management team, but there's no mention of a chief compliance officer or a chief risk officer, which you would normally expect in a company that is doing these type of transactions. So that is sort of a red flag. And the final comment I think was, the answer at the too many lawyers involved in making the calls here. Not wanting to comment, the last sentence that, we're working on it. The high legal team, high power legal team replied, it's in the board's hands. It should be in management's hands with the board's support. And if it's in, if the message goes out to the press, it's in the board's hand, she's going to get fired. She's toast, because she should be in charge.
Any other comments from George's group? Okay. Let's move on to the next group. That would be Cindy, Elaine, Marianne, and Robin.
Hi, and I'm the spokesman with support from the others. We agreed with a lot of what has already been said, in that everyone has culpability here. And this pains me to say this as a former audit partner, but you know, where were the auditors, both the external ones and the internal ones? We also brought up the risk assessment and risk officers, that why didn't they bring anything to the attention? Board has a responsibility for overseeing risk assessment, and they obviously didn't identify this area as a risk, which is pretty bizarre in today's environment, or even 5 years ago's environment. We think that the board and management need to work together. She needs some alliances. We thought it was important to hire right away that crisis management firm, as well as probably their own investigators. And they're gonna, an independent monitor of the investigation, or task force or something along those lines, to facilitate and make sure that what the FBI or the regulators or whoever comes in, you know, do a thorough job.
Okay. Any other comments from this group? Okay. Moving to the next group, we have Craig, John, Larry, and Vera.
So I'm Craig, and I'll give the summary, and guys chip in if I miss anything. You know, the problem when you go last or fourth is that a lot of it's already been said. Obviously, there was the red flag that she was aware and just either dismissed it or didn't push on it very much. Like others, we felt that there was a complete lack of controls in place for this kind of thing. And we all know these kinds of things, these rogue traders, this isn't the first time this has happened. This has happened in the past. So, you know, you at least need to be aware of something like that. But, you know, no process, no checks and balances. You know, there was no oversight of anything. Arrogant employees, the boss who was not only covering for this guy, but encouraging him. And we'll come back to this in a bit, but we believe that there should have been either some, you know, training in crisis management or a crisis management firm already engaged, so that they can be brought into action when the, you know what, hits the fan, not searching for one when you have to. We were not impressed with the position of the board. Many people have made an observation that they were more looking from an operational point of view. We thought it would have been more appropriate for the more responsible to at least have a conversation about it, not dismiss out of hand Ellie's desire to go public and explain. So the no comment, the flat out no comment, was not to our liking. We thought that something less than full disclosure, but more than a no comment, something like, you know, we're investigating this, we're looking into it, we're notifying who we have to. But beyond that, no comment for now. We'll have a more full report in 24 to 48 hours. You know, as to whether she should have been fired, we had some disparate opinions. One opinion was, well, you know, what's her performance been? Has she been delivering? And if so, you know, maybe this is just a one-off thing. We can argue to give her a pass. Others, as has been said, you know, the buck stops here. And even though there was no one on the board, not one person who supported her, you know, you know, she still could have pushed back, as difficult as it is to do that, and show some strength and courage. But again, that comes with the territory of the CEO. So, you know, in the end, we think that we think she's going to be the fall person. Some of us think the fall person should be the arrogant guy's boss, maybe the risk manager guy. But the reality is that, you know, they're going to probably go for her. Vera, John, Larry, you want to add on to that?
Yeah.
I'm sure I missed something.
No. All right. Anybody from that group want to say anything? Okay, we'll move on.
One other thing before I just know, we all agree that we have to question whether we have the right board members on the board.
Okay. Yeah. Final group is Amita, Babs, Brian, Frank, and John Morgan.
Yes, so I'm one of the spokespeople for the group, and I'll start with one of Elaine's questions, which is, who's lived through this? Having worked in financial institutions for many years and sitting on financial boards, this happens like it happens, and I've been through this. The first thing we discussed is how common things like this actually are. They are not unusual circumstances. In fact, we get pages of what are called SARS, suspicious activity reports, not necessarily internal, but sometimes it's bank tellers, it's, you know, this is not an uncommon occurrence. What they should have done before is they should have had structured policies for who can sign off on certain types of transactions and what level of transactions in place. They should have had a crisis management plan that was run by the risk department. And they should have had a crisis communications agency, PR agency, that was set up. Those people already have templates. Their risk strategy for crisis would have already listed who was in charge of the triage and who was going to organize who does what. We didn't feel the CEO should be made the scapegoat because it would cause a run on the assets or the funds. So the last thing you want to do is say that the person in charge is a problem, because then all your shareholders, all the people who are doing business with you panic, and that's what happened to SVB. SVB didn't go under necessarily because of what happened with its assets and deposits. It happened because of PR and the message getting out that they were in trouble. We noted that usually in the cases of this type of fraud, there is some arrogance. And even though companies have codes of conduct, usually the complainers of those codes of conduct are shut down or targeted themselves for complaining, because companies don't like complainers, and they usually support arrogant people who seem to be doing good things. Somebody on the team mentioned the frequency of his actions should have been noted, but these things often aren't, although there should have been a policy in place for how often he could do certain types of things. And it should be actually Andrew's manager who is scapegoated, because he is entirely responsible for not managing him. And they can use him as a scapegoat to save the company. Brian kept focusing, and also Frank, on this. We got to make sure this never happens again. So what do you put in place? Oh, the other thing that should have happened immediately was a lockdown, which would have been securing any assets or funds, because even though the person left, it doesn't mean the digital programs he put in place to transfer funds are not still there and still working. So the first thing is IT would have come in and actually locked down anything that was suspicious. And of course, you hire a forensic investigator to start immediately digging into what is going on. But the bigger thing is to stop the run on the bank or run on the financial institution from the consumers, and that communications plan that should have been in place. So the board's responsible for not having a crisis communications agency, not ensuring that the risk management, crisis management plan was in place, who was a triage manager, what the type of statements were going to be, how they were going to lock things down when something happened. That was certainly the responsibility of the board, and they should have done that. So what did I miss, guys? What did I miss?
Responsibility of the board and not the CEO to be doing those things.
The board is responsible for making sure the policies are in place, not actually getting the policies done. It is the board's responsibility to make sure they have a risk plan for crisis, a cybersecurity ransomware or plan for cybersecurity breaches. If you're a financial institution, these things are all in place. You usually have like a credit committee or an ALCO committee. You'll have committees that are... they are responsible for making sure these policies and the signatories are in place for who can do what in terms of signing off for any kinds of funds transfers, transactions, buying anything, like a procurement company has them in place. Division.
Ryan, you wanted to say something?
No, I was just going to mention to Babs, we also talked, if not the CEO, if they're not the scapegoat, because I think the four groups that went prior to us, they were kind of leaning that way. We felt that probably wouldn't be right for what Babs had mentioned, but we did think Andrew's boss certainly could be the scapegoat, given that he really didn't do his job. Also a chief risk officer, somebody of that nature, to still take steps, demonstrate to the public, you know, we understand. We've got it under control. We've got checks and balances to prevent it from happening again. But we do, in fact, need to be able to be out there and say, you know, who is going to take the fall for what's going on and why.
And certainly the person who did it is responsible, as long as they have evidence that, you know, they have to use the word alleged and all that sort of thing. But your crisis communication agency, they know how to do all this. That's why you have one.
I think at this point, let's move to Elaine. And Elaine, would you comment on the comments that you've heard?
So we don't need to go further than Babs and Brian's comments. They pretty much nailed it. Let me give some framing. So Ellie was a new CEO. This was her first CEO role. The company was a newly public spinoff of a European financial services company. So she was brought in to essentially build the company and make it provide all the critical governance and frameworks for it to be a public company. The company had been in, the institution had been in existence for a while, but is a subsidiary. So they had never had to function on their own before. So she had spent her first few years at the company trying to figure out everything and to fix whatever needed to be fixed, but to make it a truly strong reporting public company. The board who was in place when it was owned by the European parent. So some of the board members were very, very aware of US governance rules that are different from European rules, and other board members were not. The notion of this currency trading group was that it would be a great way to make a splash in the financial markets, and it was really viewed as a skunk works. So the person who was in charge of it was all excited about his ability to prove how special he could make the unit. He brought in Andrew as a currency trader from another institution because of great promises that Andrew made. And Andrew was one of these incredibly, as is always the case, charismatic, arrogant, don't touch me, don't worry about me, I know what I'm doing. And no, the kind of person who could play to his audience, no matter who that audience is. Brian, I think you've met a few of those people from the laughter I see on your face. So Andrew was Andrew, and we've all known Andrews. So what he did very, very well was keep people away from him as much as possible. And when he performed for the board, he performed for the board. And when Ellie tried to raise issues, the board was in love with Andrew. They didn't love Ellie because she was in some ways the bad mother who was trying to get everybody to play well together, to really focus on what it meant to be a public company and to get everything going and running as an independent company, which the board was not used to. So her, in many ways, her concerns and contributions, as it says in the case, were constantly undermined, both by Andrew's boss, who kept saying, you have bigger fish to fry, don't worry, I'm in charge of everything. And the board, who kept saying, this is what's going to put us on the map, and our shares and our stock price will soar because of the amazing stuff if you just keep out of his way. So because of the historical trust and the legacy trust of Andrew's boss, Ellie kept out of his way. And she was learning how to be a CEO with a board. So, which is not to excuse what she missed, but is to provide some context. And, you know, and I think the point of these conversations is to say, what's the board's role, what's the CEO's role, but what's the context for understanding how these kinds of things happen? Because to Bab's point, they happen all the time. And it's really looking at what red flags there were. All of it was a red flag. And, you know, for her, with the gift of hindsight, she never would have taken this job. She hired, the board was so angry about what happened and so busy pointing fingers at everybody else that they said, you need to follow what the lawyers say, and we don't care what you have to offer because this is all your fault. And if we can scapegoat you, then we will protect everybody else. And because you missed it, at the end of the day, it was on your watch, it's your fault. She hired a PR firm to provide her with the path forward because the board refused to bring in a crisis management firm. They said, it's your crisis, mm-hmm. your problem. You better fix it. And their stance was no comment and we're firing you so that you can take the full brunt of what's going on. Babs just keeps smiling and shaking her head no. But that's what happened. To her credit, she, this is a quote from her, but to her credit, she refused to go quietly. She knew that she missed some stuff. She, you know, there was a long list of what she should have done, but at the end of the day, she wasn't personally responsible for this. Andrew was in hiding. They couldn't find him. They did have to bring in, of course, the forensic accountants. They had the FBI looking for him. His boss was saying, well, if I had known, how would I possibly know any of this? And she didn't ask the right questions. She had the opportunity. She didn't dig deep enough. He also was not responsible. So she said that she went to the board and said, quote, I'm on to what you're doing, and I'm not afraid to tell the press, the shareholders, and everybody else in the industry, who was it that insisted on these business activities and who insisted on providing oversight that completely missed the fraudulent activity. I've kept a paper trail and I refuse to be the scapegoat.
Can you say that last part again, Elaine?
Okay, so she had kept a paper trail of every time she raised a question and her questions were rebuffed. She had taken contemporaneous notes because she also was concerned about what was happening and she felt that she was unable to find out the answers that she was seeking. She also took, and she also had the board minutes when she would bring things up at the board and the board would say, well, Andrew's boss has said everything's okay. You know, he's far more conversant with what's going on than you are. This is really important to us. Just back off and continue doing what you're supposed to be doing. So what happened was because she refused to back down, and she did go to the press with the under the advice of her crisis management firm and say, it's not a one-dimensional story. There are many people who had a hand here and I'll take responsibility as well as the other people who are. And she told the story, she told the narrative. They kept her. They had no choice to the group that said, you have to keep her. They kept her. She stabilized management. They finally found Andrew. He had been cooking the books, as you can well assume. And as soon as she stabilized the company, she said, my work here is done, and she got the hell out of Dodge. She resigned. But she resigned on her terms, not the board's terms. You know, she realized, you know, that she had been brutalized. But at the end of the day, you have to own your own narrative. And she said that's the most important lesson she learned from her crisis management team that she hired, that if you can't control your own narrative, you can't win.
So Elaine, a question on that narrative, because one of the things Babs kind of raised and I thought was a good point is, oh, wait a minute. If you point the finger at the CEO, people are going to lose trust. They're going to, you know, do a run and take their assets. how did they think that through? I know what she was doing to protect her personal brand, her integrity, et cetera, but you kind of need to do both. And what was the response, I guess, from investors or shareholders or, you know, customers when they took that?
Because she was willing to basically walk people through what she thought happened and take responsibility for the company, for the lack of oversight, she retained the trust of investors. The board was ultimately, the entire board was replaced.
And that was my question. Yeah.
The entire board was replaced, starting from scratch.
But Elaine, I said at the beginning of this that every time I've seen this happen, it's because there's somebody arrogant and they're very charming and manipulative and people just love their style and their grace and they never disagree and they're just so enigmatic and they all go along with them, even though people are going, wait a minute, something's wrong and there's people complaining. The complainers are shut down. So every single time I've seen it, it's somebody's arrogant like this. They're a narcissist and that's how they get away with it.
Well, you know, all you have to do is think about MF Global, if you want to think about that with John, what's his, Curzon. I mean, that was all, that whole, that's not this story, but that was that story. And it's almost the same. It was still a betrayal in very, very similar terms, except it was a betrayal of the board by the CEO as opposed to the CEO by the board. And so she refused. She absolutely said, we'll figure it out. We'll work with all the regulators. We'll work with the investigators. We'll work with the FBI. We will make it right. I will be here until it's made right. And then she left.
So Elaine, I have a question. Mm-hmm. The question was, it talked about employees other employees who thought that this was suspect behavior. How come no one reported it to the SEC? SEC has a rogue trader hotline as well. So just curious, did anything like that ever happen or why not? If not, why not?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. It's an excellent question, Amita. But I think a lot of times people in these situations are intimidated. And as much as it's a hotline and as much as it's all confidential, people worry that they'll be found out. Or maybe I'm wrong. They don't have the courage of their convictions unless they, you know, and in terms of, you know, look at what's happened, you know, the history of whistleblowers is not a phenomenal history. And so a lot of whistleblowers have had their lives totally ruined by reporting things to SEC hotlines, to all kinds of hotlines that then backfire. And so you have to wonder about what that balance is of, I know something's wrong and I can't put my finger on it. I know something's wrong and I've got proof. What their support systems are saying to them and what people are doing in the organization that encourages a culture of transparency and speaking out. And my hunch is that was not happening in that division because you had a boss who's watching this employee do stuff and people are saying, what's he doing? But he's shutting them up effectively by making this person untouchable. Robin?
Hi, Elaine. I was just wondering how many of the board members actually kept their seats?
None, zero.
Zero.
Wow.
The board was totally replaced.
Thank you.
As they should have been.
Yeah.
And just out of curiosity, do you know what happened to the CEO in terms of her career and where she went?
She was out for 6 months. She was she went somewhere where no one could find her to detoxify, as she described it, and didn't answer phone calls. And she came back and she was immediately offered another CEO job, which she was very prudent about accepting, but ultimately she decided to take the only job she decided that she would take would be with foundations. Not that they are always perfect, but she felt that at this point in her life, she only wanted to do good going forward and it had to be in a nonprofit.
Yeah, this is a kind of a little, you were talking about these cheats that are just They've got great interpersonal skills and can make you feel good even while they're robbing you. For those of you who like mystery and espionage novels, John Le Carré is sort of a master espionage writer because he was a spy early in his career. John Le Carré is the author of The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, Tinker Tailor, a whole bunch of movies around spying. But his last, next to last book was called The Pigeon Tunnel, and it's his story about growing up. And then Apple TV has The Pigeon Tunnel, which is an interview with John Le Carré. And John Le Carré is not his real name. I think his real name was John Cromwell, but his father was Ronald Cromwell, who was an embezzler and a cheat and eventually went to prison. And it got so bad that his mother left the family when John Le Carré was like 7 years old. And he talks about the impact of that kind of personality on him and how it shaped him to be the kind of person he became. But it's a fascinating book, and it's a fascinating documentary. It's on Apple TV. It's called The Pigeon Tunnel.
And speaking of those kinds of people, I was talking with somebody who had been trained as by the CIA as a spy. And they said that in, you know, sort of spy work 101, you're told that anyone who starts off a sentence with the words "trust me" can never be trusted. Anyone who says "trust me, I'll only tell you the truth," because they're starting with that, you know they won't. I've never forgotten that.
Well, thank you for leading this case, and thank you for writing the case, Elaine.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. It's been, you had great conversations. I love the comments that you've made, so I really appreciate it.
Why don't we use the remaining time? Is there anything that anyone needs from anyone in this group? I will tell you something that I could use. Thanks to John Ela, we have a CEO search in Concord, Rhode Island going on. And over the next few weeks, I will send you a copy of the opportunity. So I don't think, if you know of anyone who is qualified and curious to learn more, or if you know anybody who might know people who are qualified, please distribute the opportunity that I'll be sending to you. Anybody else could use any ideas, thoughts, networks, contacts? Nope. Okay, next month, we have wisely decided we are not going to compete with Thanksgiving Day, so we'll be meeting a week earlier than we usually meet, November. And Larry Stiff is going to be presenting a case, and it'll be a family business type case. And then we have also wisely decided we're not going to compete with Santa Claus next month. So we're not going to meet at all in December. So we'll have Larry, a meet in November, and then we'll meet you in January. So
Larry, what about those people who need to have a reason to escape family dinners?
They can still say they're attending seat at the table.
Maybe we should have a seat at the table. What is it called when when Strangers Night, or when you don't have any family and you're putting together a group for Thanksgiving, we should do one.
Excuse me, Mother, I have to go to seat at the table. See you later.
Eat my dinner by myself. I have an important meeting.
Right.
It may be a good idea, actually.
You take care. We'll see you next month, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Elaine.
Thank you.